As we start into the Christmas season, you're going to be hearing a lot about the birth of Jesus, really, whether you want to or not. It'll get to you somewhere or other. But you might ask yourself, I wonder if you, maybe you have asked yourself, what is it about Jesus that in Western civilization, anyway, caused this explosion of celebration? Because surely this holiday got a hold of the imagination of artists and other people. I mean, long before modern retailing got into the picture, before extravagant gift-giving got involved, somewhere before trampling deaths at Walmart, hymns were written. Life stopped, and people celebrated in ways that were almost unparalleled, at least in Europe and in the Western world. There were other, of course, big holidays, and other cultures have theirs, but this one really unleashed creative power. Is that, well, who is Jesus that this power was unleashed, or this fascination with who he was took over? There are really only four places you can find out any biographical information about Jesus. Any details, anyway, and that would be the four Gospels you have in your New Testament. So you have four different Gospels, four different witnesses, as you will, voices to tell us about Jesus. So in two Gospels, from two Gospels, you'll hear a lot this time of year, from Matthew and Luke. And that's because these two Gospels will tell you about the birth of Jesus, each in their own way, each providing some of the details you're all familiar with. Now, the Gospel of Mark, for example, doesn't have anything about the birth of Jesus. It jumps right into Jesus' ministry, right when he's about 30 years old. Well, that leaves us one gospel, the Gospel of John. And John picked a different starting place altogether when he started to talk about Jesus and who Jesus is. John starts in the beginning. And it seems to me that we don't really understand the stories of Jesus' birth that are in Matthew and Luke, unless we read the Gospel of John and where he starts in the beginning. There are 18 verses at the beginning of his Gospel. Sometimes they're called the prologue. To really appreciate this baby who was born, who has captured our imaginations, that you're going to hear so much about in the Christmas season, you need to hear what John has to say about him. Now, I've taken those 18 verses and I've cut them into some chunks here, so I'll be coming in and out of the passage rather than reading it all at once. But as a church, me, as an individual, I want to hold out Jesus Christ to you. We believe that in Jesus, I believe that in Jesus, you can find a new life, that in being reconciled to God, you can find the purpose and meaning of human existence, that you can find a way of life that will bring you healing, that what's broken in you can be fixed in Jesus Christ. Now, you don't leave it there, of course. There are presentations of what Jesus does or how he works in this world that make it all sound as if you say some magic word, paperwork is shuffled in heaven, and somehow or other you're cleared. But it seems like it's so much more than that. When Jesus changes our nature, I think we begin to experience his presence in our lives, and this begins to change us. Lots of change is needed, I think you know. Take hatred, for example. Hatred can be removed from your heart. And there's a lot of hatred in the human heart. And I think we all sense what it both does to the world, but does to us, and want to break free from it and what it's done to us. These are the kind of changes that come in a new nature when somebody really comes into the presence of Christ. So, put it as simply as it could be put, Jesus is your answer. But who is he? Because all the good stuff that's mentioned about the Christian faith depends on who he is. Guesses certainly wouldn't satisfy us in this regard. There's no point in making up an imaginary Jesus to whisper lies to you. Who is he? What's so special about him? Why does his birth unleash such joy? Now, there are all kinds of, it's not as if Jesus is just another guy with a plan to run your life, because you know there are probably all kinds of people who want to run your life. You know, if you're a child, you probably think your parents are trying to run your life. You're probably right. You know, but if you're an adult, you know, the government's trying to run your life, and politicians, and there are religious leaders around the world coming out of every doorway ready to run your life, and there are philosophies of various kinds that are going to try to present solutions for you and run your life. We're pointing to Jesus. We're saying the focal point is here. So who is he? What makes him special out of that crowd of people? Well, to tell people then, who is this Jesus? You could start with where we start at Christmas. You could tell the Christmas story, the birth in the manger. You could tell all the details that'll be in the sermons for the next few weeks, and it'll be on TV and on the radio and even newspaper articles. But start with the Gospel of John, and you start in the beginning. How did that baby get in the manger? And what's the big deal about it anyway? Well, let's go to that prologue. It's in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, the first 18 verses. And this is what it says. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him. And without Him, nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. The Word. In the beginning was the Word, but apparently we're not talking about vocabulary building here at all, because this Word is instantly personified. This Word was God. In the beginning with God, made all things with God, has the power of life, is self-existent. And in Him was life. All life will derive from this source in the beginning. Now, why John decided to introduce Jesus to us this way, say, rather than starting at the beginning of his ministry as Mark would, or in his birth, or someplace like that as Matthew and Luke would, is open to some speculation. But John starts out with Jesus described as the Word. Word is what? As the embodiment of someone's thoughts? Well, whose thoughts? This Word, in the original language, the word Word, was rich with meaning. It had specialized uses in Greek philosophy. It could mean reasoning and logic. But frankly, even though I've looked into that fairly deeply in life, I don't think you're going to find out much about what John meant looking at it that way. The Gospel of John, it seems to me, is establishing the meaning of the word Word, rather than trying to borrow it from somewhere. Well, he's reaching for something. He's trying to express something for us. God was trying to explain something to us. Today we can talk with at least a little bit of clarity about this idea of the Trinity. God is three persons, but one being. Well, that's our first enormous mystery, right at the very heart of our faith. Who is God? Defies our sense of logic. And it probably will never be stated well to everybody's satisfaction. In fact, though, that's the best we can get from what the Bible teaches. God is three persons, yet one being, one God. And people have made mistakes all through church history trying to improve upon that picture, and usually not doing, well, almost, you know, infallibly not doing so. Some made the mistakes, they end up losing sight of the fact that God is one, one being. And they end up with tritheism. They end up with three gods. It's happened when people have tried to express the reality of God being three persons with one being, as if there were three instead of one. Others made the mistake of demoting Jesus or the Holy Spirit to somehow make them less than God. And yet another mistake has been made when people tried to rethink this and they came up with the idea, well, that God shows up in three different masks as one being. But they're all mistakes, serious mistakes. And although they get reinvented from time to time in church history, they don't really ever last because they don't handle the Bible very well. When all is said and done, this points to a God who is one, but three persons. And it's the only way to really add up the pictures of God presented in the Bible. It shouldn't surprise us that it's surprising. And it shouldn't alarm us to realize once again, when we look at this picture of God, that God is not made in our image. We are made in His image. If someone makes a God who appears to be too much in our image, I think we should instantly think there's something wrong. Deeply wrong with that picture. But in the beginning was the Word, who was with God, who was God, who made all things, who is the source of life. This is Jesus. Well, to be more precise, Jesus doesn't exist at that point. This is the Son of God who exists eternally before Jesus. Jesus is going to be born in Bethlehem 9 or so months after God becomes a human being at the conception of Jesus Christ. And he will be given his name after that. The birth of Jesus is what we celebrate at Christmas. But it is God who becomes human at conception and lives in Mary's womb that makes us pay attention to that birth. Christmas is special because of who was born. We don't know that person unless we take the information that's expressed in the Gospel of John and realize that this is the very Word who was in the beginning with God. Now, the prologue of John goes on to mention the whole career of Jesus. It introduces the entire ministry, starting with the preaching of John the Baptist, but it fits here. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world. The world was made through him. And the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So here, I'm holding out Jesus to you as Savior. And it keeps raising that question then, who is he? Who is Jesus? He might promise us a lot of good things, but why should I believe that he can deliver the goods? Many people promise these things if you will follow them. Maybe weak people just invent a bunch of junk to comfort themselves in life. But when push comes to shove, calling on Jesus is little better than squeezing a teddy bear. Can't do anything for you. So who is Jesus? What makes him special? Well, we're claiming he is the Word, the light for all people, the one who truly can grant the right or the power for people to become children of God. If you're like most people in the modern world, you start with the assumption, well, we're all children of God. Well, that's half right, but in a crooked sort of way in Christian theology. We are all children of God in the sense that God made us all, one race, one species, in his image. But we are not children of God in the sense of being in the kind of relationship with him that will restore us to life as spiritual beings. In fact, each of us is born into a fractured relationship with God. And this is because we aren't good. We are sinners. And we can't eliminate this from the Christmas story. We are a race that sieges hotels and kills hostages. We are a race that tramples Walmart clerks. And we find ways to continually act selfishly and hurtfully to the people around us. It's this sin issue that has messed up our relationship with God and puts us in a situation in which choices have to be made. Do we want God? Do we trust God? Do we believe in God? Or would we rather try to run our own lives best as we can without him? These are the questions that are raised with the propositions that are made to us in the prologue of the Gospel of John. This passage says that the right or power to become a son of God, a child of God, is given to those who receive him and or believe in him. I believe he's saying the same thing there. You know, he's talking about a two-step process, and he's saying receive and believe really amount to the same thing here. The concept of believing and receiving Jesus Christ is at the very heart of our faith. We misrepresent this all the time. We lose sight of it so easily. The Christian faith does not start with you making new friends at church and then trying to clean up your act. The Christian faith doesn't start when you have the good fortune to be born into a nice functional Christian family and a church that provides you an advantageous social situation. The Christian faith starts only when you receive Jesus and are transformed into a child of God by the will of God. As John says, not by flesh, blood, or the will of man, but of God. Here in this very passage, it's described as being born. You might ask, but how can a person be born twice? It's a good question, and it'll be asked again in this gospel by a brilliant man. The Christian life starts with receiving Jesus. So, who is Jesus? He was that Word who became a human being at conception and was born in Bethlehem. Do you realize how startling that claim is? I had a good friend once who I was working with, and she wasn't a believer, and we were talking at work, and she'd gone home and gone to church with her family. She was a Catholic, and she laughed because she'd gotten up to the front of the church, or the nave, or whatever it was called, and looked into the manger scene, and there was one of these, I don't know if you remember them, Cabbage Patch dolls for the baby Jesus in the manger. She thought this was just hysterically funny, and I was laughing with her and saying, "That is pretty funny." And then she said, "It's nowhere near as funny as believing that God became a baby and was born in Bethlehem." It was cold, but it was what she believed. Do you realize how startling our claim is? The Christian life starts with receiving Jesus. So who is Jesus? He is the Word who became a human being, who was born in Bethlehem. And we know that He can deliver on the many promises to change you, change not just your status with God, but really make you a new type of person, because He isn't just another religious teacher. He's the Son of God, the Word who was in the beginning. From the prologue again, verse 14. "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." We call this doctrine of God becoming a human being the incarnation. Words fail us almost immediately. First, saying that God became man might mislead you. God became man, but didn't cease to be God when He did so. Incarnation, which always when I was young and heard that word reminded me of chili con carne, with a little linguistic sophistication, of course, you can understand the word roots are the same. Incarnation means taking on flesh, meat. But you see, this idea could mislead us too. It's not as if God squeezed Himself into a human body. You see, both that idea and the idea that God ceased to be God when He became man fall short of explaining what exactly happened here. God became man, remaining God, and became a full human being, not a fleshly bag holding God contents, as if God were taking some kind of field trip from heaven wearing a human disguise. Jesus is something new, something completely unique. Jesus was a person with a nature like ours. And so He shares more than just the human experience as a tourist. He shares human nature. So yes, God experienced hunger, thirst, fatigue, frustration, temptation, perhaps a headache or two or a hangnail. But He shares this experience from a nature just like ours. And of course, the most startling fact for us to come upon in this is that although He was just like me, imagine me or you, He never once sinned in any way. He was perfectly sinless. This is what's so startling about the incarnation. Back to the prologue, verse 15. "John bore witness of Him, cried out, saying, 'This was He of whom I said, He who comes after me is preferred before me, for He was before me.'" Well, that's an interesting thing to insert in there. And by the way, what's John the Baptist got to do with this story? I mean, especially from putting this in a Christmas context, I don't suppose any of you have a creche at home with a little John the Baptist bobblehead or something, you know, that sits in the manger and has anything to do with the story. I mean, it's a different story, isn't it? has to be preached at a different time of year. But actually, if you go back to the conception of Jesus Christ, the conception, then Jesus is, or excuse me, John the Baptist is more a part of the story than we usually remember just offhand. But you do have to save that sermon for another day. He is a principal witness. You see, we are advancing many claims about Jesus. I am this morning. And I'm obviously starting with the Bible as valid information. No, many people have not arrived where they're going to accept the Bible just because someone's quoting it. So let me just point out, if you're in that situation this morning, that the Bible works on terms that you can understand, real events, with a method you can investigate if you're a skeptic. Eyewitnesses, character witnesses, testimonies. John the Baptist was a principal witness, and he gave his testimony on behalf of Jesus, and it mattered greatly to those of Jesus' day. Continue with the prologue, verse 16. And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. It's no wonder that the Bible goes poetic on us when it starts to describe some of these amazing truths. When it begins to describe God, who is three persons and one being, the Trinity. Or when it begins to describe Jesus Christ as God become a human being, the Incarnation. How on earth can you put this into words? I think these concepts can be defended as reasonable to believe, but no Christian I've ever heard of said that this is anything more than the best picture that God can give us, that it is undoubtedly limited by our lack of ability to comprehend. It is offered to us in accept in faith and belief. Notice how the word grace came up. We beheld this glory, and we understood this grace when Jesus was there as the incarnate. Grace for grace. Grace and truth came through Jesus. Grace is a word with many, many shades of meaning. It means kindness. It can mean beauty. It means in the Scriptures a disposition or an attitude that is willing to be kind to those who don't deserve it at all. Grace and truth came to us in Jesus, who is the only begotten, or we might say God's only Son. The only place we can find out about God, because He's from the bosom of the Father. And He is gracious. And He's told us that God is gracious, kind to those who don't deserve it. God is grace, and out of His grace, He wants you to be His child. Not in the sense that, oh, God made us all, so we're all brothers in some sense, and I'll meet Him when I die. That's the usual sense in which it's expressed. But in the sense of being restored in your relationship to Him. You see, this is your choice that you must make. There's no doubt about what God would like you to choose, but it is you who must choose it by receiving, by believing, by really simply wanting to be born as a child of God. It's your choice. I beg you to consider it. Not choosing, according to the Bible, is ultimately to reject this grace, this kindness of extending. Not deciding, you see, is in itself a decision. And it's a decision against, not for, Jesus. I want you to remember the words of the prologue, that though this world was made by Him, it didn't know Him. And it did not receive Him when He showed up. You see, but I don't think that's a blanket statement. That's true in what happened in history overall, but it's not as if everyone has to fall into that category. You don't have to be that guy, so to speak. You don't have to be among those who don't know Him and don't receive Him. I didn't grow up going to church, you know, until I was a teenager, and so there's a certain fascination I have. I kind of felt like I was outside the window looking in at Christmas growing up, at Christmas in terms of church ceremonies. It fascinated me, interested me. My heart was open to what was being declared there. Now, I was raised to believe it was largely irrelevant and ancient and probably dying. I mean, that was kind of the impression I got growing up. But I, I got around it. Unfortunately, those people who invited me to church invited me to weird places. So I did, when I was about 10 years old, go to a Latin mass with a Catholic friend on Christmas Eve at like 12 midnight. What a drag. I got close to mysteries. I sensed that something mysterious and solemn was going on, but my Latin wasn't too good, you see. And a lot of the ritual was way past anything. You know, I hadn't grown up in this, so I was like, it's a long story, and it gets worse. But you see, what I'm saying is that looking in from the outside, when I became a Christian, Christmas was just a delightful celebration. I've never grown tired of it. It doesn't need to be dressed up in special clothes for me to find it fascinating. I'm happy with the corniest church program with kids in bathrobes. I'm happy with the simplest sermon that really just amounts to reading about the shepherds again. My imagination can fly. But I know, for many people, this has become a yearly round of messages that they have had with them for as long as they can remember. There's a comforting but slightly repetitious quality to it. And you've grown up a bit. Well, I'll ask you this year, when you start what might be a somewhat weary annual round of hearing the Christmas story, to remember who was born in Bethlehem. Before shepherds and the census and the long walk to Bethlehem, think of this Word who became flesh and dwelt among us and shared our human life and made it possible for those who decide to do so to become children of God. Before it gets sentimental, before it starts being a long lesson and being friendly to one another and loving kids and family feasts and decorating, recognize the enormity of the thought that God became man, and that all the good things we will say all year in church, all the good things we might say about Jesus or ask ourselves to do because of Jesus, all of them, every single one of them, depends upon this truth. Every single one of them. I understand that for many of you it will be something you've heard in detail since your childhood, but perhaps this year, in spite of this, or maybe because of it, you can get the bigger picture of the story. Go back to the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.